Hi, everybody. We're about ready to get started here with our player panel. My name is Steve Berthiaume. For the last 12 years, I was at ESPN, one of the hosts of Baseball Tonight, and now I'm very happy to say that I'm the TV play-by-play voice of the Arizona Diamondbacks, and been here for about 2 months now, so this is my first opportunity to say welcome to the Valley. This is a great week to be here. This is the best time of year to be here, and certainly for baseball people, this is even more so this week with the World Baseball Classic at Salt River Fields and Chase Field. So thanks for being here, and we're happy to have you. I'm here to moderate the player panel, talk about analytics and their practical application in the clubhouse and on the field. And we have two outstanding pitchers here to talk about that. Everybody here knows Brandon McCarthy, new star pitcher for the Arizona Diamondbacks, who are expected to win the NL West in a runaway this year. Wait, what? And Javi Lopez, who would probably disagree.
Fair statement.
From the world champion San Francisco Giants. Guys, thanks for being here. Brandon, let's start with you because you have quite literally become the cover boy for analytics and their practical application. Can you sort of go over your history with analytics and how you got started?
It really kind of started through the Fire Jim Morgan website. That's where I sort of fell into it, and that's kind of developed sort of a love with it that it just kind of, I thought it was funny at first, and then I realized there's actually a good basis for this. And then I just sort of took that and ran with it. When I changed the way I pitch, I changed my style, and I sort of did it to fit a different model. The more strikeouts, more ground balls, less walk model, which seems common sense, but there was a good number background to it that I tried to fall into. So it's just something that I still pay attention to. I'm not religious with it. I don't go truly in-depth analyzing the game because I think it gets too far off course for me, just trying to stay mentally clean. But it's still something that I do pay a lot of attention to.
Javi, how about you?
I really got introduced to it with when I was with the Red Sox. Bill James obviously went over there, and with Theo Epstein and the rest of that crew, a bunch of Yale Ivy Leaguers really running the show, and that's when I was really introduced to the numbers and the number crunching and the information overload that they can throw at you was really quite impressive and quite intimidating. And, you know, again, much like Mr. McCarthy was saying here, you don't want to put too much into that. Obviously, the information is pertinent and something that you want to apply, but you got to be able to take some of it in. I think a lot of it gets you with the analysis. There's a little bit of paralysis at times when you're out there on the mound. And I had the fortunate teammate of mine was Curt Schilling, who was big into this.
He's a bit of a talker.
He loves to chat, no doubt about it. He loves to chat, and you know, the funny thing was is that for those of you who have seen me throw, I am a left-handed sidearm, submarine, depends on how my arm feels that kind of day kind of guy. And Curt Schilling would tell me how to pitch and the things that he'd be picking up on. And it's kind of funny because you'd always think, you know, right-handed power guys talk to right-handed power guys, relievers talk to relievers. But his knowledge of this this kind of statistical analysis and things like that it was quite impressive at the time, and that's kind of where I got interested with it.
It's interesting, the two approaches, because, Brandon, you seem to have done this almost on your own and sort of initiate this investigative journey to try and really get into it and analyze how you might change, where your career was headed, where, Javi, you almost were sat down in front of a computer, it sounds like, and shown different things. When they did approach you with everything in Boston, how did that go? What did they actually say and do?
Well, obviously, it came to the point. As a player, your sole goal is to get to the major leagues and to play at the level and try to sustain some sort of success at where you can stay. And that's what everybody thinks about at that point in time. And, you know, you're worried about what you're going to eat and how you're preparing for the day, let alone who you're going to face. So when it came to number crunching and things like that, it was kind of funny to see guys, when you get the sheets and you would see the bats and the player profiles and first pitch swing tendencies and batting averages, 0-2, 0-1, 1-0, all the percentages and left, right, night, day, night game, day game. All the information was just, it was eye-opening to a guy that was just basically trying to get his feet wet in the league and just trying to stay around. And knowing that you can take some of that information and, again, apply it the best you can. Obviously, not everything's going to work, again, for the way I throw, but the general core values seem to play not only for myself, but for every pitcher, including, like he said, changing around to being more of a contact guy, letting your defense make some plays, and, you know, limiting the walks, and just trying to keep the game as simple as possible, if And that's really almost impossible to do in baseball, but that's what you try to do.
Was there a specific analytic or a specific number or something where it sort of clicked for you and you said, okay, this I can really use and apply every day?
Well, I think, you know, there's a little bit of everything when it comes to that. For me, it was kind of funny going through just really keep, for me, it's simple. I like the simple stuff. So at the end of the day, if you ask me, I throw 20 pitches and you ask me what I threw, I could ballpark the number of fastballs I threw, you know, sinkers and changeups and stuff. But to actually look out on a spreadsheet and look over a 10, 15 game period and have your numbers broken down as to the exact amount of pitches thrown, 75% fastballs, 15%, you know, breaking stuff. It's kind of funny to have that in front of you because in your mind you think you're pitching totally different, but that's where the numbers don't lie. They're right in front of you, and that's where you come up with a game plan because I think the more information that we get, I think that's a reason why I do continue to have a job in the major leagues because, you know, everything is becoming specialized and more specific and, you know, being able to come in and face a left-handed hitter with the funky style that I have, I think those are the kind of things that keep me around and keep, you know, give me a little bit more value than maybe 10, 15 years ago, let's say. And, you know, so my numbers, I try to keep them simple. Things I like to focus on are how hot the hitter is. I don't care so much about their career stats. Obviously, they're here. If they're here, they're there for a reason. So I care about the hot, cold zones, and what have they done in the last 2 weeks, let's say, before we play. Because, you know, it doesn't really matter. It could be a career 220 hitter that you're facing, and the guy in the last 2 weeks has hit 450. And those are the things that I kind of focus on. His first pitch swings, what he likes to hit. And again, I try to look at what lefties do against certain people, but not too many throw the way I do. But those are the kind of things I kind of just throw in and out. And you know, you take what's good for you, and the rest you leave for somebody else to chew on.
Sounds like a win for Mark Simon out there for ESPN. Heat maps, Mark.
There it is.
Brandon, you mentioned there was a common sense element to it. But you would think there would be that big a disconnect between a pitcher saying or realizing at some point, okay, it's a lot better to throw ground balls than it is to throw fly balls.
No, you wouldn't think, but it's and he kind of touched on it. Your whole goal is to get to the big leagues, and it doesn't really you're not really interested in changing what you do if you're on that path to get to the big league, and especially if it's gotten you there. It's one of the hardest things, and it's why so many players are. You know, don't want to adjust is because it's gotten you to the big leagues. And so even when you're there and you're struggling, it's still sort of, well, I've been successful. I can keep doing this. So to me, even though I knew there's probably too many fly balls, there's way too many home runs, there's too many walks, there's a million different things. It's I've been successful at this before. I'll get this back. I can do this. And it isn't until you finally sit down and you get honest with yourself. And like he said, when you see numbers in front of you that this isn't good, you're not very good here, and you kind of see that reality, it doesn't hit, and if you don't want it to hit, it won't. But for me, it just kind of one day, it just was, this has to change. I have to be better at this, and this was the only way I could figure to go about that.
Now, your model was Roy Halladay, right?
Yeah. It was just a complete copy job. I mean, there's no other way to put it. It was watching his games over and over and over again and basically just going out and trying to just imitate.
Now, how did you pick him specifically? Just because obviously he's a very good pitcher, it's a good model to use, but was there something other than that that you liked about his game or his style of pitching?
No, he has a nice beard. I wish I could have his beard. It was kind of, the comparison I draw is I'd love to be Justin Verlander too, but I can't throw 101. There's a lot of pitchers that you'd like to be like, but I can't do what they can do, and I felt like Roy was someone that I could sort of do what he could do, at least in terms of velocity, body size, what I look like relative to the hitter. There's little things there that I felt like, okay, he just throws a sinker and a cutter. I can do that. Let's see what I can do with that. So copying someone else that doesn't make sense to me, a Lincecum, a Verlander, I couldn't do. It was just trying to find someone as close or as similar to me that I felt that I was close enough to be able to copy.
Now, I know Javi does his own thing in terms of his sidearm or submarine delivery, depending on the day. You also changed... I should say you did the opposite. You changed yourself physically in terms of your motion, right, and your mechanics to match Roy Halladay and fit that model, Brandon?
I tried. That was the slowest thing to come. I was able to kind of manipulate the ball, but then it was finding a consistent delivery. There was only so much I could copy him, and then what was kind of weird is while I was doing that, I was actually playing in winter ball with Charlie Morton.
Who's also copying Roy Halladay.
And at that time... apparently, we were both doing it, and neither one knew it. because he came in a spring, and I had no idea where that came from. He hadn't been like that a few months earlier. So I tried, and then there were some things that he does that I couldn't quite fit in and couldn't get comfortable with. So what I just tried to do was make as much of a hybrid or find the sticking points in his mechanics that I felt were that made him successful, and try to incorporate those into mine as much as I could, but without making it a complete replica.
Did you find through the transitive property you were then actually trying to imitate Charlie Morton and not Roy Halladay so much?
That was the joke at the whoever I was playing that with that year, I can't even remember now, they kept saying I was a Charlie Morton clone. And then I got bitter because I thought I was doing it first before him, and apparently he peed me to it.
Now, it's interesting to see how this has sort of seeped its way into the culture here. Javier, when you were sat down in Boston, were you told, okay, this is the way we're going to do things here and you need to embrace it, or was it just presented to you as an option?
No, it was definitely presented as an option. Obviously, again, the sole focus of any player in the locker room is getting outs, a pitcher in particular, just getting outs however you want to do it. Another guy that really embraced the number crunching and kind of just the statistical analysis and game planning was Jason Veritek. And, you know, he was the kind of guy that had the kind of brain where he could sit in back of the plane, play cards, and go through a scouting report and nail it every time. And, you know, it's many pitchers I've thrown to him, including myself, I feel like he's one of the best guys I've ever had catch me. And in particular for that reason, he has a game plan that he wants to execute. Obviously, he tries to build off of everybody's strength. Every good catcher does. But, you know, those things were definitely an option. You know, it was a lot of things were suggested. You know, this is a formula that has worked, and this is a program that you might want to get into. But again, it was a lot of things were just baby steps, kind of doing that, kind of getting your feet wet with it. And again, I don't like to go with too much of the analysis part. I just try to, you know, pick some things that are going to be able to I'm going to be able to replicate in my mind and mechanically, where, you know, I can visualization is a big thing. And I, again, those hot and cold zones actually works for me. I can picture, once I face a guy a couple times, I can picture the zones when I'm facing them. And those are the kind of things that I kind of draw from when I'm out there on the mound.
Now, away, when you're away from the front office guys and the coaching staff as a group, as a bullpen, let's say, what's the discussion when it comes to analytics and their applications?
When
there's no one listening.
That's another one where you're not sitting in a room here with a bunch of people sitting in chairs. It's one of those things, again, where either a lot of people are in and a lot of people are out. It's much to do about nothing at times. I feel when you're not an overpowering pitcher that you lean and you draw from these things. I feel with the guys that I played with before that can run it up there at 95 to 100, you can get your margin for error is just greater. Your ability to make outs on just pure stuff is just better. And when I try to reach back and give it all I got and I see 89 popping up on the gun, I got to realize that is not the kind of pitcher that I am, and I have to be able to sink the ball, move the ball, much like my man here to the right, and just keep hitters off balance. And coming up with a game plan like that is kind of something we talk about. And, you know, again, people are receptive to it. Some people turn their back. Either way, it's going to be in the clubhouse, and it's something that, you know, the paperwork is there. It's been proven that it does work, you know, to varying degrees, depending on who you want to believe, how much it does work. It's there. There's some validity, and it's something that it's going to be here to stay.
Now, Brandon, it was about a year ago at this time that you and your wife were now famously on the cover of the ESPN, the magazine analytics issue, and you've, in a sense, from a player perspective, become the face of this. And how's that been for you over the course of the last year? Do you find that other players, fans, come up and want to talk to you about this type of stuff?
No.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
In terms of players, there's been little, you know, kind of conversations here and there. It was more just about how I changed and less why or how to translate that into numbers. I'm not big on sitting down and breaking teams down and going through scouting reports. Everything I do is kind of individualized. So I don't really dive too far into that with anybody. And if someone wants to approach me, that's fine. But I try not to take it out and throw it at people. For the same reason I wouldn't want it thrown at me, because it does cloud things up if you aren't prepared for it, or if you're not not able to kind of decipher the information. So there hasn't been a lot of conversations with it. Fans certainly don't come up and talk to me about it. So it's just kind of a personal thing for me right now, I guess.
What about defensive metrics? Is that, Javier, do you look at that at all, or do you, as a pitcher, have an eye test for when a ball is hit and you look behind you? And I know you don't know everyone's defensive metrics off the top of your head, but how does that factor in terms of a pitcher using the eye test to measure defense? Because that has such a subjective element to it.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, obviously I've seen some of those numbers and statistics kind of put out there, and you know, obviously I don't think he can generalize something like that. It's tough to really narrow somebody down with their physical ability. But again, there is something to that. But again, there's so many different fields that we play on, different type of surfaces that we play on, that you might have a guy set up perfectly, but the ball's just, Arizona is a great example for one. It's just a quick infield. It doesn't matter. I'm a ground ball pitcher, so that's what I'm looking for. I want to make sure my guys are where most of my ground balls are going to go. And I've given up many hits where I turn around and I'm like, man, I executed a good pitch. The guy was just a hair late. And it's not that his range was any different or anything like that. It's just the way the surface plays. And that's where again, it gets a little hazy at times. Most of the guys know the way I'm going to pitch. And I'll make sure I check with my infield before I even execute some pitches. But it is one of those things where it's just kind of like obviously, it's gaining momentum. There's going to be some way to try to quantify that kind of information, but I haven't found anything that's really hit home for me yet as defensive alignment and how to rate a guy's ability. But that's just my own personal opinion. I'm sure there's plenty of people that could tell me more, and I kind of look forward to it.
Brandon, what about you in defense?
It's something that I think it hasn't come along as far as I think anybody would hope at this point. And so it's something that I can't pay enough attention to it because I don't understand the information. I'm not the one who can break it down myself. And that's my biggest problem, where if it's not kind of cut and dry and here's the answer, it's hard for me to dig deeper into it. And especially if you try and take that out into a team atmosphere. Breaking down someone. We know that on-base percentage is a better measure of a hitter, most likely than batting average, but you still talk with players and you explain that concept to them and they still think it's batting average. So it would be especially hard to tell someone that this is why this defender isn't as good because these numbers are saying so. It's very hard to describe and break down. And until those numbers are not more accurate, but I guess more easily explained, more practical, something that you could show somebody, It's pretty hard to take this discussion any further than just some sort of a kind of acute side thing.
Now, offensively, we heard a lot, of course, about the WAR debate during the offseason and the AL MVP vote, and some people were saying it's the perfect number, it covers everything, and other people are saying no, it's more of a jumping off point. Is there a pitching metric or a pitching analytic that you prefer that more so than the others that you think may sum it up more so than anything else?
If I'm looking at somebody, if someone asks me who had, did so-and-so have a good season last year, I'll look straight at FIP. I look at their whip as a quick rounder. I still look at ERA because I'll be 80 and I'll still look at it because it's just trained into me. I've stopped looking at wins. I've gotten really good at that. And then strikeouts to walk. So I try and get a quick overview of something, but that's about as far into it as I've gotten yet. As I go away from the game and I start to look back at it, I think I'll start to look more into things. But just now when I look at something, I look more on surface. So it's the surface underneath the surface, I guess.
When there's an arbitration discussion in a closed room or there's a contract discussion, do those numbers come up or is it still wins and ERA?
It is still wins and ERA. It's such a weird little system because you know that the front offices know what we're all talking about, what everything that's written, and they're, in some cases, the pioneers of it. We know it because the agents have to look into it, and then as players, anything that tells you you're better than other people are saying, you want to know about it, so you know about it. And then everybody gets into a room or on a phone call and acts like they don't know what they know, and you're talking about stuff that doesn't exist, and that determines your money for the next year or your contract. So it's a weird little system that I think needs to improve because it's very much left behind.
Javier, where are you with pitcher wins? It's almost, at this convention, it's virtually a dirty word, but do we get rid of it altogether?
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's fine. I think I've pitched, I'm going into my 11th year in the big leagues and I probably have 25 wins. So I don't think it's really going to, it's a determining factor as to, my contract or anything like that, considering I need, who knows, 280 more before I even get a chance for the Hall of Fame. So, You know, I'm...
Well, with your motion, maybe.
Hey, you never know. I mean, again, Windsor, I can see the argument on both sides. Obviously, that's like Brian was just, or he was just discussing that, Brandon was saying that the wins and losses are important for your money, and that is very true. And if you look again on the surface, like you were saying before, that at a whip and things like that, that's a good general overview for guys. But I've been on certain teams where guys have won 15 games with a 5.5 ERA just because their offense is covering eight runs a game. And you know, so again, yeah, you're winning the ball game, yes, sure, but you know, would you be winning those games if you're up 3-2, if you're playing three-run ball games? That's where I think there's going to be that fine line. So if you were to take that out, that's fine. For me, again, I'm a reliever. It's a different story for me. But, you know, ask me if I was a starter, I'd probably be like, yeah, add up those wins. We need them all. You know,
well, let's get an official answer from the starter. Do we get rid of them altogether?
I really wish we would, more because I'm sick of talking about them. I don't like looking at it. It's just such a weird thing. And it is still trained into me. I know when I'm going to get a win. You know when you're not. I don't care because it to me is more based on the process of the game, what's happening. But you do know I got the win or I'm not going to get the win because of that. And you hate that it matters, but when your entire financial structure is almost based on that, it's just going to kind of stay a part of it. I want it gone because it just doesn't tell us anything. It doesn't tell me anything. I can't look back at Wade Miley's year last year and see, you know, I learned nothing by looking at his wins and losses. It's just one of those numbers that just doesn't do anything for me.
Now, I want to ask you one question about offensive players, then we'll open it up to questions on the floor. When we were going through the AL MVP debate this offseason, and I was working at ESPN and talking to players and analysts and ex-players, and it was very, very interesting discussion. Every player and ex-player, every single one, said that Miguel Cabrera was the hands-down MVP and was an absolutely no-brainer. And every research person, every sort of columnist, every analytical person said, Mike Trout is the AL MVP. It's not even close. It's an absolute no-brainer. How do you guys, as some people who have looked at analytics and used them and have practical applications, how do you quantify guts or clutch or grit is a word we've heard a lot with the Diamondbacks this year. Where is there room for that in all of this?
I don't know where, and it's probably my biggest point of contention when it comes down to award times and people discussing that he was the most valuable to his team because it's impossible to quantify, and usually you find. You know, it's usually a local reporter, a beat reporter, who gives a vote for a local guy, but I totally get why. Everybody skewered a couple years ago Evan Grant for voting for Michael Young. And I know Evan well, and I know why he made that vote. And to him, it probably makes perfect sense. Michael Young is a fantastic guy in the clubhouse. He was, you know, everybody goes around him, and you see that a team kind of feeds off that. But it's impossible for anybody on the outside to quantify that. So it just makes too many people look silly, and then it also leaves too many people without the big piece of information that someone's voting for, that, you know, he's a great leader, a great clubhouse guy, whatever it is. So I don't know how you actually define any of that, and I don't know how that focuses in. I wish it would just be left purely to numbers, take the success of a team out, just leave it as what actually happened on the field, and then that's the winner of the award. But I don't know if you could ever actually make that full switch.
Javi, what about you?
I think that's a very fair assessment. I feel, again, when you were looking at that debate, I think a lot of it had to speak to history. You don't see guys getting triple crowns very often, and I think that carried a lot of weight. Now, again, it is some of the numbers are a little bit archaic at times, but I feel that either way, you're going to pay to watch either one of those guys play. So personally, as a player, as a fan of the game, I would have been happy with either one. It wouldn't have stuck in my craw if Trout would have won or vice versa. It was just, I think there's going to be something to that. And I think anytime there's something for discussion, I think it's a great thing. And, you know, if that's going to be the discussions from here on out, whether it be Cy Young Award winning, whether it be, you know, pitcher winning an MVP, you know, is that something that should even happen anymore or anything like that? I think those are, anytime there's a discussion, I think it's great for the game and just great for a player just as a fan of the game to see all different sides because we're so narrow-minded. We're just focused on wins and losses and trying to make it to the postseason and make a run. We're not worried about overall personal awards. We're just, those things will just come, and when you get into those arguments, it's kind of funny to see different points of view and different statistics that come out at you that you don't even think about. And again, that just adds to, I guess, the narrow-mindedness of a baseball player in general. At least I'll speak for myself on that, you know, narrow focus. And it's when you get back and you take a step back from the game and see the big picture, it's entertaining.
The analytics can get a little bit clinical, and there's always a human element, but some analysts will tell you if it can't be measured, therefore it can't be valued. And Brandon, I was interested to hear you refer to Michael Young, and you used the term clubhouse, and that's one we hear all the time. Team X has acquired player Y because he's a great clubhouse guy, and a lot of people scoff at that. How important is that type of thing?
It is actually really important, and the only reason I'll say that now, and I'd say that much more now than I have in the past, just being a part of the A's team last year, and you see the value of what a few guys can do, that I think if you take a Johnny Gomes and a Brandon Inge away from our team last year, it's at best maybe a 70-win team, and that's not just their value on the field, it's what happens behind closed doors. What I get from looking at from everybody else's perspective is that you can't quantify any of that, and there's no way to, so there's no way to ever truly measure any of that, and so why even talk about it? But it does exist, and if you go back to someone like a Michael Young, and you know, where, again, you can't quantify, but if Elvis Andrus is struggling, and Mike is the guy that says, listen, I've done this before, this is your fix, do this, or this, you know, little guideposts you bring guys into, Elvis gets better, he improves the next 2 weeks, and that contributes to a win or two for the team. That's something that nobody else sees. You can't possibly quantify it, but it does actually exist. There's something there that happened that wouldn't have happened had he not been there. And so even if he went, you know, his rate of, you know, what he was doing on the field was the same at that time, he actually did something that contributed positively to the team. But again, you can't do anything more than just discuss it because it just dies right there.
Yeah, Javi, I think Hunter Pence is a great example of that. When he showed up with you guys last year, the numbers second half for Hunter as a Giant don't jump out at you. But one of the images we have of your World Series run last year is Hunter Pence doing his Ray Lewis imitation in the dugout. How big a factor was that for you?
I think it's a major factor. Obviously, again, you're spending 180-plus days with guys. It's a family whether you want to believe it or not. So at times, like any other family, you're going to have disagreements and some arguments, and you need a guy, maybe a couple guys, actually, that can be sounding boards for everybody in that locker room and be able to find a common ground to keep everybody on the same page and on the same task. And the playoffs in particular with Hunter, it was just that's exactly what happened. Bruce Bochy, if you've ever heard the man talk, he's a little rumble down here and you can't hear him. So, you know, he gave the inspirational speech to start that. But he's very monotone. I mean, his message is great, but you could sense the tension in the room. And then Hunter decides to step up and again, do, like you said, is Ray Lewis, the thing that works on Friday Night Lights kind of thing. He's just, you know, a lot of passion, a lot of fire involved there, and it let guys take a deep breath and relax. And again, you don't have a measuring stick for that, but that's exactly what happened. And, you know, same argument can be said. We went in, we're down 2-0 in Cincinnati, and he has the inspirational speech, and we still get no hit. You know, so it's still, you know, did it help guys? I mean, sure, I think it definitely does. It loosens the locker room, and I think there's a lot to being a guy like that, and I think that's why you see certain guys kind of bounce around, and Johnny Gomes is a perfect example where everywhere he seems to go, the team just picks up their play, and it's not even so much what they do on the field, but it's off the field, hanging out, having meals. Those little things are, again, you can't quantify, you can't put a number on it, but it does matter when you're spending 8 months together. Those things will affect your play.
Well, we want to open it up to questions. We want to make sure we have enough time for that. We have two microphones out there, and if anybody has a question for either Javier or Brandon, please shout it out. Raise your hand, and we'll get a mic to you.
Javier, I have a question for you. Last year when Santiago Casilla had some trouble and manager Bruce Bochy went to somewhat a closer-by-committee kind of plan, which folks in the analytics community kind of argue, you know, should be the thing, that kind of
sure.
Thing, you know, it's just not utilizing players to the best of their abilities, and can you talk a little bit about kind of how that worked for you personally, whether that, you know, kind of closing by community that the Giants did, that you were called in on certain occasions to close out games, and how that changed your preparation, how, you know, have the analytics kind of saying use your best guys in the best leverage situation kind of work from your perspective. I had a chance to talk to Jeremy Athol about it a little bit, and he said it kind of worked because of all of you guys, but he hates it, and he hopes that, you know, it doesn't happen this year. But,
yeah, sure. Obviously, Jeremy and I, we've had that discussion as well, and you need to have the right kind of bullpen for it, and I feel when you look at the Giants' bullpen, we're not an overpowering bullpen. We maybe have one power, real true power arm, and the rest of us try to manipulate arm angles and bat speed. And the one thing that we had going for us is that we had a decent amount of guys that are good strike throwers and contact guys. So when it came down to it, the egos weren't even a factor, which I think becomes an issue with some other teams and maybe some other scenarios where you have an incumbent closer who's been struggling. Now what do you do? You know, ours was cut and dry because ours got hurt. So Brian Wilson was not even a factor. So it was just thrown upon us. And the one thing that Bruce Bochy did, and it's a credit to him, he changed one guy's spot in the game, and that was Santiago Casilla. He was throwing the seventh, eighth inning every once in a while, and move him to the ninth. And you kept Romo and myself and Jeremy and some of the other guys throwing those eighth innings and seventh innings where we had been all year. So you're not asking everybody to make that adjustment. So we really did have a closer to begin with. And then that let everybody get acclimated to that, where the preparation's still the same. You're still focused on, again, I'm focused on the lefties that I'm going to be facing regardless of when that is. Jeremy's probably doing the same thing. But Bochy was going to put us in positions to succeed. And that builds confidence, and not only in what he shows in us, but what we can show in him and in the team that, so, you know, power righties are coming up. I know I can take a seat. I'm not going to be pitching those innings. And those are the kind of things that we could all feed off of. And when Santiago began to struggle, that's when everybody realized what exactly we were doing, because we were still pitching in the same roles, but asked to do maybe a little bit more, just a little bit every time. And once Casilla started to struggle, then, you know, Romo was able to jump in and get a few saves. I jumped in and got a few. Affel jumped in and got a few. And that's where it kind of was. We were just kind of picking each other up. And it did, obviously, if you're playing fantasy football or fantasy baseball, it doesn't work because, you know, you want your guy to get 3 or 4 saves a week. But for us, it was working. And I think, you know, when you look at the A's team, I feel like you guys kind of did the same thing last year where, you know, all of a sudden Sean Doolittle comes in and he's pitching lights out. Okay, you're going to give him an extra couple outs to go get. And you're kind of just working the guys through. And I think that's ultimately one thing for sure. It keeps everybody fresh. That's what I feel. You know, there's the times when we'd be throwing Wilson, you know, 4 times in a row. And ultimately, he's a warrior, but that's just fatigue and age. And all those things are going to come into play, and pitch counts and things like that. So it kept everybody fresh. It kept everybody into a ball game more. I hate to say more so, but it did, because it might be just coming in for one out, and it's a big out. And a lot of that credit goes to Bruce Bochy to accepting that what we had going and putting guys in those positions.
Can I just ask you a follow-up question? Sure. Is the ninth inning, you know, just different for you? I talked to Alfred about this. I said, well, isn't it harder to come in and face the 3, 4, 5 guys in the eighth inning than, you know, 6, 7, 8 or whatever, 7, 8, 9, you know, in the ninth? And his sense was, no, the ninth is the ninth, which, again, is like, the analyst team
doesn't yeah. I feel that the ninth inning is its own beast, in a sense that when you pitch in the sixth, seventh, eighth, you have a safety net most of the time. If you're in a ball game, whether it's a one-run game, whether you're up, you're down, you're going to play situational baseball. You're going to try to keep the score the same regardless of if you're winning or losing. You want to keep your team in it, or you want to hold down the lead. So every out's going to be important from the seventh on, let's say. But in the ninth, there's usually just one guy out there. You don't have the safety net. Now, we did a lot of that this year where, say, the ninth inning started with a power lefty. I would come in knowing that that's the one guy I'm facing, and knowing that I have Sergio Romo, who's a strike thrower, strikeout guy, behind me. So those were the kind of mentalities that we had going. Now, when Romo picked up and just went on his own, I think that was a little bit of an adjustment for him, but he made it rather quickly, you know, because now he's facing lefties, and he has to believe that he can get his sinker over and get the changeups over. Because in his mind, nobody can hit his slider, and to be honest with you, not many people can. And that's, I think that's where the ninth inning becomes its own beast, where you don't have the safety net. In traditional bullpens, you don't have the safety net. Now, when you're going by committee, then it's not as big a factor. But I feel like when you have that lockdown closer, they get paid what they get paid for that reason, because they know that they're going in to get three outs. And sure, it might be a three-run lead, and it might not be as critical as maybe the sixth or seventh inning when there was a couple guys on and you're getting out of a jam. But at the end of the game, it's still tough to do, and that's why I think a lot of guys have difficulty becoming full-time closers.
Should the save stat be altered in any way, or is the save stat okay with you?
I think the save stat is okay the way it is. I mean, obviously they have the varying degrees of difficulty, I guess, you know, on the save. But I think the save in itself, I really don't have an issue with it. Again, it comes down to me being that middle reliever guy where it's not affecting my paycheck either way. You know, I saved seven games last year. I say.
Did you bring that up at all?
Yeah, you know, I bring that up and they're like, congratulations. That's it. You know, so, you know, it's just one of those things where if that's where my bread is buttered, then I want to keep it. And that's just kind of how I look at it.
Next question. Yes, sir.
What about the idea that baseball players, especially relief pitchers, want to know what their roles are? Is it really as important as that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I feel that's, again, my opinion. But I think when you go into any job, you don't want somebody to just hand you a notebook and a piece of paper and say, go get them. And you're like, what do you want me to do? So as a pitcher, that's what I want. I want a guy that's going to tell me, you're going to come in and face primary the lefties, and you're going to pitch in the eighth inning. And you're going to split the inning with so-and-so. Okay, done. That's perfect. The problems that you get into when you have a bullpen, especially when guys don't know when they're throwing, the preparation suffers. You feel like you're doing the right things, and all of a sudden, let's say the game speeds up, a guy has a bad start, gets bounced in the fourth inning. Now you're having to cover those next four or five innings. That's where things kind of get a little wishy-washy, because then you're like, all right, well, I only pitch when I'm winning. But then all of a sudden the phone rings, Lopez, you're in the game. Now I've already shut down mentally. So those things are kind of important. You want to know when you're going to throw. You want to know who the first guy is that's going to be up. And again, it's never going to follow that way. 162 games, it's never going to follow that blueprint. But as close as you can stay to that blueprint is pretty important.
My question is for both of you. Go ahead and take it. Do you guys, in certain game situations, pitch to the score? Or do you alter pitch selection, pitch sequence, depending on who's on deck or who you're facing?
I don't ever. I think Buster Olney was covering this for a while last year. There were a few guys that were talking about this, and I started, me and Brett Anderson started talking about it, and Brett has actually clued in a lot of this, and we both agree that we've never, ever thrown to account a situation, a score, or anything. It's just, if he wants to throw a slider there, he's throwing a slider. If I want to throw a sinker, I'm going to throw a sinker. It's just every hitter is an independent entity, regardless of the situation that's happening. And I don't know if that actually hurts me. There's a possibility that maybe because there's a runner on second, somebody's trying to do something, but I'm still just trying to get that hitter out the way that I feel is best. I talked with some other pitchers who said they do pitch to score, they do change some things, but I don't think it was as much as they said it was. They kept inventing situations when we talked about it, and I don't think it's as much. I think everybody has that fear of just not getting a hitter out, and it's just, you just want to get the guy out no matter what. And I feel like if you're pitching the score, if you're doing any of that, there's a mental weakness that comes with that, because you don't ever want to give up hits. You don't ever want to give up runs. So just because you're up four and you have the comfort to give up two runs, I can't imagine that mindset. So while it might exist, it's just something that I choose not to acknowledge.
Hi, I get a question over here. I'm coming from Mexican Winter Baseball League, and all of these advanced forms of evaluating players, you know, the WARs and all that, the UZs, they're not very much well-known down there. But as a league directive, as a GM, how can one reach a player and, you know, present all of these cases of new forms of evaluation without, you know, pretty much hurting anybody's feelings and letting somebody know, you know, you're either not that good because this represents where you're at, or, you know, just wanted to know from the player perspective.
I guess be a really, really good communicator and good with your words. I think a lot of it's just going to be depending on the player, just case dependent. Some people will be open to it, and if you tell them, listen, you have to take more pitches in this count to be better, or you have to, you know, whatever it is that you're doing, this has to improve if you want to be better. Maybe if you put it in dollar and cents terms, that's a thing. And then some people are just going to flat out be stubborn and they won't be responsive to it. I don't really have a good answer for that. I think that's one of the hardest things that technically the Sabre movement faces is the practical application. How do you get that to players? How do you get that to people? And what I found now is that there's more of it being backdoored in, where it's less actually going to the players, you need to take more walks, you need to do this. Instead, we will just find players that take walks, we will find players that do this, and we will put them in spots. And eventually players will kind of figure it out and probably adjust, but actually relating on a one you know, person-to-person basis, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel it's a tough sell, honestly. I agree. There are inherent egos going on in these clubhouses. That's why we're at the level that what we do. I feel that, not to take a jab at anybody in the room, but sometimes critics are your best friends because they point out your flaws, and you have to be an honest self-evaluator. But again, it's going to be on a communication level. It is difficult to sit somebody down and tell them the reasons you're struggling are X, Y, and Z, and you need to maybe just think about doing it a different way. When you've shown that you've had success one way, you want to think that you can draw on that. And to some extent, you can. But obviously, baseball is always evolving. The game itself is always evolving. And the numbers are going to continue to do that. So you have to be an honest self-evaluator. And that's something that is tough to do in an ego-driven kind of profession.
Yes, sir. Down front.
Javier, you said earlier that when you're studying opposing hitters, you're looking at hot-cold zones and you're looking at their performance over the last couple of weeks. So let's say you've got a hitter that you normally approach in a certain way, and you see that he's red-hot or ice-cold. How does that affect the way you would approach him, knowing that he's red-hot or knowing that he's ice-cold?
Yeah, I guess I also should have said that besides looking at the numbers of the hot-cold zones and how they've been, whether they're on a hot streak, regardless of their overall numbers, what their hot streak is, I definitely try to pitch to my strengths. You know, Brandon was saying that too, where he's going to throw the sinker, he's going to throw the slider. That's how I'm going to execute. Now, when I'm facing a guy that might be locked in, let's say, I'm a fan, knowing that I'm facing a lefty most of the time, I'm a fan of throwing a ball inside. Moving feet, moving the upper body, something that makes them uncomfortable. I rely on deception and movement with my arm angle, but sometimes that's not enough when a guy's locked in. It doesn't matter. They keep the front shoulder closed. They're going to stay in on me. So I need to dictate the tempo in a sense. So knowing that they might be staying in on left-handed pitchers with balls down and away, I need to get you uncomfortable. So not only with my arm angle, I'm going to try to move your feet, try to get in your... I wouldn't say getting in your head, but just try to make you uncomfortable, and that's what I try to feed off of. But ultimately, I'm going to throw the sinker-slider package that I basically throw to everybody. But when a guy's more dead red, been hitting fastballs a lot more, I'm definitely going to try to lock in on the off-speed stuff early in the count. So knowing that my 86, 87, I might be able to sneak one in a good spot as opposed to coming right at the guy with that pitch and knowing that he's sitting on it and that's the kind of things that I like to have dictated. I just try to, when I have that information, I try to come up with a game plan, and I try to dictate the count. Now, obviously, that's not going to work all the time, but that's the information that I enjoy.
Anyone else with a question? Yes, sir.
Javier, you mentioned earlier at Jason Varitek and how he was into the analytics. Have you found, as you've gone through your career, that generally you've been able to have catchers who harmonize with that kind of thinking generally? Have you found any instances where there's been some resistance on the part of catchers? And just as an aside, is it also a situation where you might have a pitching coach that might take a different view of analytics than, say, Varitek did in that particular instance, or Schilling did?
Well, I'll address Varitek first. I feel, again, he was locked in on all aspects of the game, all facets, and I feel like that's something that helps a young pitcher at the time, which I was, really just understand the game and understand what you're trying to do. And again, I'd go out there, and not just myself, but a lot of the younger pitchers would have success, and it would almost be a question of he'd finish the inning and kind of question you, like, do you know why you had success? And you'd be like, oh yeah, I was locating, and you know, he goes, no. Because you're setting your pitches up. You're throwing an off-speed stuff early. You're slowing them down. and then you're speeding them up, and this is what we did, and this is why I was calling certain pitches, and really opening your mind to that part of the game as opposed to just, you know, feeling good about yourself and patting yourself on the back. And I feel a lot of I've had catchers that have been resistant to that, and they shall remain nameless, but it's just that they had enough going on. They felt, you know, they might be maybe a little more offensive oriented than defensive oriented, or they might just have their mind on something else. And it's a grind. I mean, it's for a starting pitcher. I'm sure you can speak to this. I haven't started since I was in the minor leagues. You know, I was that bad that I became a reliever. So, you know, if you can become a starting pitcher at this level, if you're pitching the way you want to pitch and coming up with a game plan, you should be exhausted. Most of the guys I pitch with, they're tired mentally after a game, not only physically but just mentally with the program that they've had. And so there have been some catchers that just don't want that feeling, knowing that they got to do it night in, night out. You know, it's easy for a starting pitcher or a pitcher in general. You know, the most I've thrown is 77 games in a season. So, you know, not even half the time. But as a catcher, you're catching 150 games. If you're an everyday guy, it can wear on you. So some of the guys don't like to do that. They can be resistant to it. As far as a pitching coach, I've definitely had a guy like that. And, you know, Joe Kerrigan was big in the numbers, big. And in a sense, it was great because he would tell you that, you know, Albert Pujols doesn't like when you're up in the count on Albert Pujols, curveballs is a better pitch than a slider. You know, it's breaking down. And I said, that's awesome. I don't have that. You know, but it's cool, you know, and a lot of guys could feed off of that. And Charlie Morton's one of the guys, you know, hey, you can pound him with a sinker in. He doesn't like to be able to turn, doesn't like the ball down and in, down, and then curveballs down in the zone. And that's great. And a lot of those things are great, but they don't apply to everybody. So that's where it becomes a little bit difficult for me. But I do like a pitching coach. I feel if you're going to be resistant and ignore the numbers, then I feel that you're not going to ultimately help your guys achieve their best. And when you have those game plans, whether it is with a pitching coach or it is with a catcher, it builds confidence. And this is such a confidence driven profession that you want guys to be able to do that.
Yes, sir.
Going back to what you were talking about, trying to make the hitter uncomfortable, flipping that over, you talk about how in the end it's a battle between pitcher and hitter. Is there any count or anything that a hitter does that makes you feel uncomfortable? And if not, you guys, do you think other players in the league have counts or hitters do anything that make them uncomfortable?
This is going to sound really weird. Hitters that we call them like good unis, like guys that look good in the box, and this sounds so stupid. I don't know if anybody remembers Troy Gloss in the World Series when he took off and he looked like he was holding a telephone pole. He just looked like a baseball player. Like those guys, for some reason, there are guys like that. Buster Posey's one of them. There's other ones that they just looked, they look twice the size they are. You'll see them early that afternoon in the gym and they look normal. And then in the box, they look humongous. You think, I can never get that guy out. In terms of actual counts or anything, there are certain things when they do something completely unexpected is when that can throw me off. The other day in a spring training game, I threw a first pitch sinker. It was the first time I'd faced Zach Cozart. First pitch sinker, got it right where I wanted it to, and he absolutely killed it. A home run to left. And that to me is now I have no idea what to do with Zach Cozart from here on out because nobody.
He did follow up by striking out the next five. I was there.
None of them were Zach Cozart.
One of them was Johnny Cueto.
So when he comes up in the regular season, that'll be.
I couldn't. I mean, it's right there. It was ordered, I think, not to swing, but we're getting away.
And one of them with the ball. So that's what will throw me off more than anything. Jeff Francoeur we actually had a conversation about him yesterday. He does things all the time where he swings at pitches that you feel like he has no business swinging at, not location-wise, but an account where you think there's no way that's what he's going to do, and then he swings and he hits the hell out of one or he doesn't, and it just kind of throws you off that I don't know what I'm game planning for here. And the only analogy I can draw is poker. If you're playing with someone that does things that you can't predict and you're just sort of sitting there, you can think all you want and that guy's got the better of you because you can't predict it.
Anyone else? Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask both of you, we talked a lot about some of our discussions talked about the history and tradition of baseball, and I'd like to ask both of you, growing up, did you ever look at the history of baseball pitchers, and what comes to mind that was a big influence of you, if it did, by either watching them or through film or studying analytics, that fascinated you or motivated you or somehow was an inspiration to your career?
Brandon, you were a big Oral Hershiser guy, right?
I was, yeah. I mean, I grew up with the mid-'80s with the Dodgers and Oral Hershiser, and, you know, there were a lot of guys there that I looked up to. But in terms of it helping form me as a pitcher or anything like that, I don't know that that has an effect, because I guess you're young enough then. And then even as I continued to grow up in the 90s, we didn't have the wealth of video that we have now, or especially going back, or that access to it, or, you know, a channel dedicated to it where you could see Juan Marichal throwing or someone like that. So to me, it was just, you knew what you saw every night. So if it was Tim Belcher throwing, if it was Oral Hershiser, those are the guys that you knew. Historically, without the access to it, it was kind of hard to draw anything from that.
Yeah, I would agree. For me, it's kind of odd story, but I definitely didn't want to be a pitcher. I was always coming up as a position guy, and I loved Cal Ripken Jr., and I told myself I'd be the first left-handed shortstop every day in the big leagues, and that clearly never panned out. But, you know, I would look at the numbers with him, really, in particular, with the Lou Gehrig chase, and just seeing what he was doing compared to some of the other great shortstops in the past. And I grew up, my dad was always told me about Roberto Clemente, because I'm Puerto Rican, so he always told me about that. And then Willie Mays, just being the guy that he is. And so a lot of my stats came from, I hate to say it, but those bathroom books that are like fact books, you know, baseball facts, and you just, those little things that you'd sit in everybody's bathroom, at least when I was growing up, and I'd sit there and I'd read ridiculous stats that guys would be putting up. And that's kind of what piqued my interest, I would say. But there was nothing that I really drew. There was nobody that I was like, okay, I'm going to model myself after, in a sense that I'm going to try to emulate his stuff. But now being able to look back on some of the information, and, you know, it's kind of funny. I talked to Willie just a couple days ago about this, that he won the MVP in 54, and he hit 41 home runs. I think he had 100, he hit 345 and maybe 120 RBIs or something. And then the next year he hit 51 home runs, stole 30 bases, had more doubles, more triples, more homers. He finished fourth in the MVP. And he just laughed and he just said, well, they didn't want to give it to me 2 years in a row. And, I, you know, those are kind of little funny things that now I can look at and just realize, now that I'm face-to-face with a guy that is a Hall of Famer and a place that I would love to be, probably never going to go besides as a visitor, and be able to have these discussions, I think that's what's kind of cool, to see what they were able to achieve. And another one for me as a pitching side is Gaylord Perry. Just watching that guy pitch, you know, I think he has 300-something, I forgot what his 300-however-many wins, and he's finished 315 of those games, or whatever it was. I mean, he's got, his stats are ridiculous. And you look at today's game, I mean, I can't even fathom guys doing that. I mean, Roy Halladay, you know, might lead the league with six complete games or something like that. And that's just, and you think that's all on, like, just your jaw drops on that. And to think guys in Gaylord's pitching, they're starting 30-something games a year, and they're finishing 28 of them. That's pretty impressive.
Well, it's 6:30, so we have to wrap it up. I want to thank all of you for coming, and a special thanks to Javi Lopez and Brandon McCarthy.
Thanks, guys. Thanks,